Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Passion and genius and a willingness to risk it all. It's a recipe for wonder. And when we return, we take a journey to the mind and spirit of scientist, explorer, artist, and friend of the earth, Dr. Roger Payne. Each time you hear a humpback whale sing, you scratch one notch on his totemic legacy. It's off to the sea we go. Get out your telescope and search with us for the new lands of our future when we return here on the Wildside News. Welcome back to the Wildside News, and we're continuing a journey with a couple, a very interesting couple. I think of them as Earthmates. They met sort of over the issue and the substance of the earth and have become life mates, quite honestly, in a larger spectrum. They really are trying to do everything they can to preserve life on planet Earth here. Roger Payne is an extraordinarily legendary scientist and researcher, specifically as it relates to whales, and I'm sure many of the listeners are familiar with one of his most significant early works, which was a series of recordings, because he was one of the people who discovered the fact that humpback whales and other whales, which made all these sounds and different things, as all animals do, but he was able to take this and analyze it and say, you know, they're not just making noises here, they're communicating, and the communication is at a very high level. Roger, welcome to the Wildside News.
Thank you so much. Sydney, I can't prove communication in whales. What whales are actually doing was producing songs.
Okay, the songs, truly. It was the songs of the humpback whales, to be very specific. Talk about that, the songs of the humpback whales.
Well, they're wonderful, extraordinary utterances of animals which are... So they seem to be some form of communication which speaks directly to the emotional sense of people, and some people respond to hearing them for the first time by weeping. And so you get the impression of something with an enormous power over just the human imagination. There are some interesting aspects to them. My former wife, Katie Payne, discovered that they change, and that also she and another woman, Linda Guinea, discovered that they employ rhyme in their songs and change the endings of various phrases as they're changing them. They maintain a rhyme, for example. These rhymes are used in the songs to apparently remember complicated stuff, because songs which are more complex have more rhymes in them than songs which are very simple and straightforward. And so it seems to be sort of the same kind of mnemonic or memory device which the old troubadours used in order to remember stuff, by using rhyme as a way of tweaking their memory and getting the next phrase. This fact that humpbacks sang was something that Scott McVeigh and I discovered together, and it's a really exciting way, we felt, of getting the world interested in stopping the killing of whales. And I think it proved to be so, and it's one of the things that spurred the start of the movements like the Save the Whales movement, really, which were taken to much greater heights by other people. People like Greenpeace and other organizations took it a great distance, and gave us eventually a moratorium, and all of us began to think at that point, ah, well, we've done it, we've saved the whales. And now I realize, it took me a while to realize it, but in many ways a moratorium is the best thing that ever happened to the whaling industry, because everybody thought, well, we've won, and gave up and got interested in other things, and the result is the whaling industry is inexorably moving back, coming into existence again. Nobody listening to this program will live long enough to see the end of whaling. It will go on and on and on, and the people who profit from it are just getting cleverer and cleverer, and at the moment they are persuading other nations to join the International Whaling Commission. And these other nations, because of the gratitude they feel to the whalers, are voting with the whalers, even though they include nations like Tuva in Asia, which I think, I don't know, maybe it's probably at least 1,000 miles from the nearest coast. Not a very famous bunch of whalers.
Well, we've come a long way since the time of the original Song of the Humpback Whales, and the issues are becoming much more complex. The more that we learn, the more that we understand that as our societies are expanding their realms into the oceans and their technologies, and now we're having the military usage of the ocean for various forms of deep sonar, that we're really beginning to affect the capacity specifically for whales, conceivably, to communicate or to sing. What is happening with that? Are we making progress in this arena in trying to turn this around, or are we going the other direction?
Well, I think people are finally beginning to recognize how serious the problem is. Chris Clark, who worked early on in his career with me and is now going way, way beyond mine, Chris has demonstrated recently that the area within which two whales can expect to hear each other in the North Atlantic has shrunk by two orders of magnitude, by something over 100 times. So they used to be able, a thing that I proposed years ago and Chris later confirmed by observation in the ocean, these whales are able to hear each other completely across oceans. Well, they were, and now they can't because there's so much traffic noise in the ocean. They're down to hearing each other in a very small little area. Now, whether or not that's going to have an effect on their population is not known, but my guess is, let's see, do we think it's going to improve their chances of meeting each other and reproducing or not? Because this is a species that does not collect together on breeding grounds. It's the species like the blue, the fin whales, they just wander the world's oceans and presumably come together by hearing each other's songs. And those songs are now being drowned out by ships' traffic.
Roger, tell us what kind of noises are being added to the ocean environment that are affecting their communication.
Well, the worst thing is the propeller noise from ships, and motor noise to some degree, but propeller noise far more, and the whole ocean is simply throbbing with ships' traffic. There's no place you can go and get away from it completely. You can get to areas where the sound is less loud. But in major ocean areas, which are crisscrossed by shipping lanes, you have 24 hours a day this kind of roar going on. The ocean has always been a noisy place. Originally, it would be before there were propellers in the sea. Sailboats don't make any noise to speak of, but the propeller-driven ships began that, so about 150 years ago it all began. There is in the ocean a whole collection of sounds which have been there all along, and at the very lowest frequencies there are things like the earth cracking and little tiny tremors of the earth, which are really earthquakes, but just tiny little ones, and very nearly silent ones, but they make a low, dull roar, and then things like storms and wind noise and tides dragging stones across the bottom and waves crashing onto beaches and rain on the surface, and then also flashes of lightning. And flashes of lightning now are louder than a great many sounds that are produced by human beings underwater. Only explosions could equal that. There are tens of millions of lightning flashes which are striking the earth every day. Year, and most of those go into the ocean because the ocean is 70% of the earth.
That's amazing. I had no idea that lightning would actually have that impact, and therefore maybe in some respects it makes some of our noises and the challenges that we create for whales well within the realm of acceptability.
Yes, they are perhaps tolerable, but that's because for the most part they don't last very long. A lightning bolt doesn't last very long. But it does tell you that whales have to have mighty resilient ears if they're going to live in this loud noise background. And I suspect that they're capable of dealing with a lot more noise than we're afraid they are capable of dealing. But the precautionary principle is in order here. It's not wise to just go ahead and blast things into the ocean the way we now are doing. The two major sources of real acoustic damage are something which are called air guns. It's an array of noisemakers dragged behind a ship, which sets up very loud sounds that go down to the bottom and actually penetrate substrates and tell the oil industry what's lying underneath the bottom at that point. But of course, any of the industry that pays for such a survey won't share the results with its competitor industry, so you have the phenomenon of areas which are crisscrossed by one company after another, which is an outrageous waste, really, of the ears of the animals that have to listen to all of this. The other great problem seems to be at the moment what are called mid-range sonars, sonars which are used by warships to locate submarines, anti-submarine sonars. There's been a lot of discussion about extreme low frequencies, and I can't imagine they do much good to whales, but I don't think they represent the threat that a lot of people have thought they do. But air guns and mid-range sonars sure do.
The fact that these are continuous now in some areas, is that leading to evidence of true disorientation by whales?
There's very definite evidence that whales are put up onto beaches, particularly at the moment beaked whales, as a result of the loud noises that are made by air guns and by mid-range sonars. There's really no question that that's happening. So one of the things that needs to be done is that where these sonars are where practice runs are being made with them, and also where the oil industry is working, they should pay attention, close attention, to whether or not there are whales in the area at that season, and if there are, to wait until the whales have moved on.
Are you finding acceptance by the oil industry to work with you in this regard?
This is all too early to say. It's just brand new. I believe that their interests will be for the better and that they will work with us. That's what I'm looking forward to.
You have a wonderful ship called the Odyssey, and you've been on an Odyssey for the last 4 years. Tell us about that, and I'd like to know sort of what you've discovered that perhaps you hadn't really known that you could discover, and then also what kind of vision does this create for you in terms of where you look into the future from here?
Yes, well, my institute, the Ocean Alliance, has a boat called the Odyssey. It's a 93-foot steel ketch. It's been going around the world for, as you said, this is its fifth and final year. It has taken samples of the skin and blubber from 1,100 sperm whales. The reason we're choosing sperm whales is we're interested in what the concentrations of pollutants are in the little plugs of tissue that we get from the whale. And the pollutants we're after mostly are synthetic pollutants, things that humans have made that animals have not had a chance to develop or evolve methods to get rid of, and which accumulate in animals and cause them terrible mischief and terrible problems. Collectively, these things have a lot of different names. One of them is persistent organic pollutants, and the worst of those are things which are called EDCs, or endocrine disrupting compounds, because at incredibly low concentrations, they can mess up the endocrine system, the reproductive system of animals, and cause all kinds of terrible results. Nobody has looked globally at this problem. People have looked very specifically and done excellent work in little small areas to different species of animals, but nobody has tried to find out, okay, if this really is a problem to the oceans, you know, how far do you have to go to find out about it? And nobody has gone out there. And now I know why they haven't gone out there, which is that it is fantastically hard work over a long period of time. Raising the funds alone is just a monumental task. And also the finding and getting close to and getting a sample, a good sample from 1,100 whales is very hard to do. But we've now done it, and we've been out in the very most remote ocean regions. We've found sperm whales virtually everywhere we've gone. They're a wonderful species to study for two reasons. One, they have a lot of fat, which concentrates these substances. POPs are most soluble in fats. And two, they are a species in which females live in a completely different area than the males, and males then come visiting in order to mate with the females. Females live in equatorial or tropical waters, and the males go to polar waters, both the northern and southern polar seas. And as a result, when you get a sample from a male that has come back for mating with a female, you know that its blubber was laid down not in the tropics but in the polar seas. So you have samples from all over the world by keeping your boat out of harm's way in calmer oceans and collecting samples from both males and females. The way we get the sample is to shoot a little dart into the back of the whale. Usually you don't get any response at all. When you do get a response, it's never very violent. It's just a twitch, basically. There is no more difficulty approaching a whale 5 minutes after you've taken a sample from it than there was when you got the sample. So they don't seem to now suddenly associate, you know, some horrible pain with the approach of this particular boat. In fact, I'm not even sure they're aware of it a lot of the time. The little hollow tube that gets the little plug of blubber and skin from the whale is, in relation to the whale size, about half the diameter of the very smallest hypodermic syringe needles, which are used by diabetics to inject themselves four times a day. So it's not a huge trauma on the whale, I don't think, but it will, I hope, help make the whale's home, the oceans, a safer place for them and for the other top predator that feeds at the tops of long food chains in the oceans, and that's us. And the reason feeding it on food chains is an important issue is that there is a concentration of pollutants as you move from one predation level up to the next, from one food pyramid or food chain step to the next. And at each new level of predation, you end up with about 10 times as much concentration of substance as you had in the previous one. So that if you're feeding at the top of a food pyramid that is seven steps high, that's about where you and I eat fish, for example, that means you have a 10 to the 7th increase in concentration. That's a 10 million times increase in concentration. So you can start with things that are vanishingly small concentrations in the ocean and build them up quickly to give an idea of how bad that can be. In the case of pollutants like PCBs, polychlorinated biphenyls, this is a substance that is found in so many substances it would take the rest of the show to list them. These PCBs are now no longer intentionally made, but they're made at times in small quantities unintentionally, and they still are all through the environment. They were made, their principal use was as a liquid insulator inside of capacitors and transformers and power stations, and if all that material gets into the sea, we will lose access to fish in the sea. It'll just be too polluted to eat. The U.S. government says you can sell fish as long as it has no more than 2 parts per million of PCBs. If it's 50 parts per million, it's defined as a toxic waste. So what do you find in whales? Well, in mid-ocean, in killer whales, which are feeding on mid-ocean prey and not coming to the mouth of some river where there might be a factory upstream causing pollution, in these killer whales, you get 400 parts per million. If you do move into a river mouth, like, for example, the St. Lawrence, and look at beluga whales, up to 3,200 parts per million. And if you go off the east coast of the United States, off Megalopolis, you get 6,800 parts per million in bottlenose dolphins. You know, that's flipper. So these whales are basically swimming toxic dump sites. They would be eligible for cleanup under the Superfund site laws if you could clean them up, and you can't. Or if, I might say, the Superfund sites were being cleaned up, they're not anymore. It's all been put on hold. So the result is that, you know, this is a terrible, terrible threat to these animals, the buildup of these pollutants in the sea, and it's clearly gone way over limits that are considered to be toxic wastes by people. Just as a last note, if you took pity on some dolphin which had come ashore and it happened to be very polluted and you pushed it back into the ocean to save it, you would be eligible for a $10,000 fine for polluting the sea.
I'm laughing because it's weird. This is part of the sad truth. I think to help people understand, too, why this is so challenging, some people could say, well, so what? So the whales are getting polluted and their blubber is getting filled with toxic things. It's like, so what? But, you know, one of the disadvantages of the poor sea creatures is the fact that they're stuck in this environment. It's like one of the reasons that the frogs are going through such changes is the fact that the subtle changes in their environments, they can't escape because they're waterborne, and the whales as well are stuck in the water. So anything that goes into the water reaches everywhere. And the changes, as you say, specifically in the endocrine systems, are some of the most dramatic because they affect the capacity for this animal to function. And from my perspective, that's one of the biggest concerns. Are you finding that somewhat true?
Oh, absolutely. You know, with wildlife, there are abundant indicators of real problems in wildlife. You have fish which are genetically male, but phenotypically, in other words, the way they look is female. You have alligators with minute penises. You have all sorts of terrible problems with the beaks and the feet of seabirds and so on. And one of the most interesting things I ever saw was I was visiting a man who was one of the discoverers of the problems of club feet and twisted beaks in seabirds, and he pointed out that one day he finally realized, hey, wait a minute, you know, these are the animals that survived enough to hatch and develop and grow up, but what about the ones that were so badly affected by these substances that they didn't survive? So then he began going to the eggs of these same seabirds and collecting any which didn't hatch And the stuff he got out of that would, I mean, make you say to Hollywood, come on, guys, get real. You know, what do you think you're trying to put over on us? I saw, for example, one of the embryos which he had collected, which was a heart with two eyes on it. Mm-hmm. I mean, that doesn't seem to be quite right. And you and I and everyone listening to this are in fact eating the stuff that produced that, and we're getting it with everything we eat, and we don't care, apparently. We just figure, oh, well, too bad. If a nursing mother had her milk in other containers besides her breast, she would not be allowed to take it over state lines. It's too polluted. Yet, she, in that tenderest of all mammalian acts, nursing, is actually dumping her lifetime's accumulation of this stuff into her baby. Now, there's a way around it for a mother. She can feed her baby formula, but that's not an option for a whale. So you can perfectly well say that whales, unless that somehow the pollution of the ocean is diminished by the steps that people take, are probably destined, in the case of many individual species, to go extinct. I see no way around that.
That really is your conclusion at this moment.
Absolutely. I mean, if you can think of some mechanism that will clean up the sea and therefore the whales well enough to prevent these substances from accumulating inexorably from generation to generation, you see, it's not just, they don't concentrate only as you move up food chains, they also concentrate as you move from generation to generation. So the baby that got a meal from its mother got basically its mother's lifetime accumulation of stuff up to the point when she gave birth to the baby. Then the baby adds its own lifetime accumulation to that, the baby whale, let's say. And then the whale, then she gives birth to a calf of her own, into which she pumps milk, which has, therefore, twice the accumulation she got from her mother. And that calf will pump milk into its babe, which will have three times the amount that its grandmother had. So you add this up with every generation. It doesn't matter if it's a very small amount that's added each time. You will accumulate it inexorably, and eventually you reach concentrations which will, I presume, cause havoc with endocrine systems.
The capacity for these animals to naturally reproduce, natural animals, is becoming very seriously threatened, and it's tragic. I was hoping you were going to give me a good answer as to what we might do. If you could wave a magic wand, let's dream for a moment here. How could we turn this around?
No, I think we need to care. We need to, you know, when I'm, let's say you and I own a power company and the transformer just went out, and we've got to get another one online. We have irate customers calling in saying, you know, where's my power, and so on. And now you have this old beat-up transformer that's no use to you anymore. And the question is, well, what do you do with it? Well, I don't know, you get the damn thing out of there, you get rid of it. But the point is, if there were a law and a little market that could be built up, you could persuade some local guy to buy up an old used fuel tanker from some trucking company, and he could have a little business going around collecting the oil that was in these transformers and taking it down to some facility which can either oxidize or reduce it down to its completely harmless components, and that would mean it wouldn't get into the system and eventually make its way to the ocean, which is where absolutely everything that spills on the surface of the earth eventually ends up. It may take a while, but it eventually gets there. Then people used to say, oh yes, the solution to pollution is dilution, and there's plenty of water in the ocean and you can dilute things, and the answer is wrong, because what happens is there is this inexorable building upwards in food chains of concentrations until what you end up with is this stuff being fed back to you at concentrations which, in fact, can really cause you trouble. So I always used to imagine the scenario of a mother grabbing a bottle of this, well, some PCB, let's say, from the hands of her child and thinking, my Lord, he almost drank it, and then pouring it down the sink, which basically guarantees that it will come back either to that child or some other child somewhere else, because it will be reconcentrated by food chains and then eaten as a nice fish someday when somebody has fish.
In my experience, there are people who understand these things. It's almost like people are born into the world with this caring sense about their relationship to the planet and the living systems. And then there are those who seem not to. It seems to me the challenge is, how do we reach those who don't have a natural proclivity to feel these things? Any ideas on that?
I don't have any that I think would necessarily do the job, obviously, completely, but I do feel it's a matter of education, and that it's a matter of the kind of education that really sticks with you, which is often very informal kinds of education. I've always thought there ought to be a soap opera, basically, on with you know, an interesting group of people in it that the listeners and or viewers got to know, and slowly they would face various problems which had to do with the environment, but not done in such a way that was jamming it down your throat, but in fact which was subtle and funny and made the people who were involved in it entertaining and fun to be around, so to speak. Because when you're in this field, when you're a scientist and you know, you did your time, you learned your stuff that you had to do it, and you interact with other scientists who are doing the same kind of things, you find they're wonderful people. They're fun to be with. They're a ball. I have a few of my colleagues. Tom Eisner at Cornell, who's a man who really taught me biology, he's one of the most entertaining individuals I've ever met in my life. He's hilarious, as well as being such a fine scientist that he won the Presidential Medal of Science. I mean, they're people of that sort throughout, and they're just a ball to be around. They aren't some thick head in a white coat making pronouncements. They're wonderful human beings who really have something to say.
When we come back, we're going to experience another level of this discussion as we look at Lessons from Copernicus, which actually begins to take that concept and flesh it out and craft it into something that you too are reaching out into the planet to try to really bring about a greater caring world. So, Roger Payne, I want to thank you for being on the Wild Side News at this point. And then when we return, we're going to get Lisa and Roger together. Thank you.